A tsunami rips points across the Pacific from Japan to California. The source, an underwater volcano off the island of Tonga. Eruption tremors were felt in towns some 500 miles away.
At first it was sort of like thunder, but it just became very constant, like bang, bang, bang. And then the tremors sort of started, like the door of the pharmacy started to sort of shake.
Also ahead, in the Arctic, the ground is thawing, then literally sinking.
You imagine like you build a road on an ice cube. When that thaws, the road moves.
I'm Marco Werman, and rethinking French salad dressing.
If you look at it, most dressing of at least 25% sugar. If you have more than 20-25% sugar, it is a dessert.
Save dessert for after the meal, not for the salad, say the experts. That's all ahead today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. Thanks for joining us, and a happy Martin Luther King Jr. Day to you. We begin this week deep under the South Pacific. On Saturday, a massive underwater volcano just 40 miles away from the main island of Tonga erupted. It sent a mushroom cloud of volcanic ash high into the atmosphere, followed by tsunamis across the Pacific from Japan to California. In Tonga, reports have emerged of battered coastlines, damaged buildings, and fallen ash blanketing the landscape. Tongans are starting the cleanup, while experts are saying the eruption is not over yet. Reporter Ashley Westerman starts us off.
The eruption of the Hunga Tonga Hunga Ha'apai volcano knocked out all phone and internet service throughout Tonga. What little information has managed to get out has been mixed. Tonga's High Commissioner to Australia, Curtis Tui Halaninya, told Radio Australia Monday that the situation is not yet stable.
According to what we have, it's minimal damages and no death yet. And we hope that it will continue on to be in that direction.
Meanwhile, Australia's acting High Commissioner in Tonga, Peter Lund, posted Sunday on Facebook, accessed via satellite phone, that the capital, Nuku'alofa, looked like a moonscape, covered in ash, its coast battered by tsunami waves. People as far as 2,000 miles away could hear the eruption. 500 miles away in Fiji, Vikrant Singh tells me the sounds reached him late afternoon Saturday.
While I was walking from the car park to the pharmacy, I was hearing all these booming sounds, which at first I ignored.
And then they got louder.
At first it was sort of like thunder, but it just became very constant, like bang, bang, bang. And then the tremors sort of started, like the door of the pharmacy started to sort of shake.
As the booming and shaking continued, Singh headed down to the seaside, where he saw what looked like the beginning of a tsunami.
The water, the ocean at the seaside, started to recede.
He stopped to take a video.
The water just receded and you could see all the sand, and then it just comes rushing back in, and then it recedes and comes rushing back in.
It wasn't until then that Singh learned that the shaking and booming was coming all the way from Tonga. The U.S. Geological Survey said the eruption caused the equivalent of a 5.8 magnitude earthquake. Videos recorded in Tonga before telecoms went out show a giant plume of ash rising above the ocean nearly 20 miles high. Tongan authorities issued a tsunami warning for the country's roughly 100,000 residents, and it wasn't long before people started sharing videos of huge waves crashing into the shore of Tonga Tapu, the largest island, under a darkening sky. Then everything went dark. At least online, phone lines and the internet are thought to have been knocked out when the eruption Saturday severed an underwater fiber optic cable. Following the eruption, tsunami warnings rang out across the Pacific, with places as far away as Japan later reporting waves up to 3 feet. Marco Brenna, a volcanologist with the University of Otago in New Zealand, says Saturday's eruption was a 1-in-1,000-year event.
Over the previous 100 years, there was nothing really that was indicating that there could be such a very large explosive event ensuing. So I think it caught everyone by surprise.
The eruption was so powerful that the volcanic ash plume grew to 180 miles across in less than an hour. It also produced an atmospheric pressure wave that scientists say reached as far as Finland. This is the volcano's second eruption in less than a month, and Brenna says it's not finished.
There will probably be still, hopefully, small-scale eruption ongoing for several weeks. now that the volcano edifices have collapsed, there is basically a free pathway for magma to reach the surface.
That could hamper post-eruption cleanup, experts say. Back in Fiji, Vikrant Singh says he's concerned about more eruptions in the coming weeks.
It's quite scary to think that we could be having more of that, or potentially even stronger ones.
Volcanologists predict the following eruptions will be less intense than Saturday's. Both New Zealand and Australia are readying aid to send to Tonga. Experts say restoring power and providing clean drinking water, uncontaminated by fallen ash, will be top priorities in the coming days. For The World, I'm Ashley Westerman in Manila.
When it comes to the latest wave of the pandemic, hospitals are struggling to cope in many parts of the world. In Canada, the crisis underscores the fragility of their publicly funded healthcare system. From Toronto, reporter Anita Elash has more.
Veronica Hua was supposed to go to the hospital for a hysterectomy at the end of this month. Her doctor arranged the surgery last fall after discovering several large tumors on her uterus that have caused years of excruciating pain.
When you're in a situation like mine, where there's degenerative condition with chronic pain and a severe impact on my quality of life, it's not elective. It's urgent.
But last week, her doctor's office called to say that, urgent or not, her surgery would be postponed indefinitely.
It was a very short and to the point phone call, and there are no next steps at this time.
Hua is one of tens of thousands of Canadians who've had surgeries and medical procedures postponed or cancelled this month because of the pandemic. The number of COVID cases is skyrocketing across Canada since Omicron took hold. In Ontario, where Hua lives, Premier Doug Ford says that to keep beds open for COVID patients, only emergency procedures should go ahead.
We've started to see an alarming number of new hospital admissions. Now with triple-digit admissions into hospitals every single day. If we don't do everything possible to get this variant under control, the results could be catastrophic.
Dr. Fahad Razak, an internist and a member of Ontario's COVID Science Advisory Table, says the cancellations underline just how stretched Canada's hospitals are.
When you hit the point of winding down surgical services across the province, for example, it's acknowledging the fact that as a system, we are on the brink for capacity.
Canada has fewer hospital beds per capita than almost any other industrialized country. Administrators cut beds over the years to account for the fact that more procedures are done on an outpatient basis. But Razak says the cuts went too far. Even before the pandemic, hospitals were often overflowing with patients.
Because of lack of resources, they ended up being cared for in the hallways or in atypical spaces like a converted closet, because we just didn't have the physical capacity to provide rooms for their care.
Staffing shortages have exacerbated the problem. At the downtown Toronto hospital where Razak works, about 7% of the staff are out because of COVID. As a short-term solution, Ontario's government said this week it will hire 1,000 foreign-trained nurses who aren't yet qualified to work in Canada, but who could help fill the gap. Dr. Stephen Archer is a cardiologist at Kingston General Hospital in eastern Ontario.
So I don't worry so much about COVID patients.
He says he's confident that COVID patients will get the care they need, but he says he and other specialists at his hospital have had to delay procedures for dozens of other people who had already been waiting too long.
People that are my elective cases waiting are people with chest pain, positive stress tests. They're very symptomatic. And normally they'd wait 2 weeks for an outpatient angiogram. Now they're waiting 2 months. And I really can't guarantee their safety during that waiting period.
Veronica Hua says that without her surgery, doctors predict her condition will keep deteriorating. She's already given up her work as a touring burlesque dancer and storyteller to cope with the pain. Now she's questioning the government's commitment to providing decent health care for all Canadians.
It's kind of a mix of sadness and anger. Just white-hot anger towards the medical system in Ontario. They've had 2 years of this pandemic to improve a system that was over capacity before the pandemic, and they didn't.
She says she still believes that Canada's publicly funded system is better than the private system in the United States, but she's not sure how long that will last. For The World, Anita Elash, Toronto.
If you use a personal computer or a smartphone in China, you might get an unwelcome surprise. The Chinese government spying on you. That's why several Western nations, including the U.S., are offering a bit of unusual advice to their athletes preparing for the upcoming Beijing Winter Olympics. Use burner phones or other disposable devices. Isaac Stonefish knows a lot about the risks of surveillance in China. He's a CEO of Strategy Risks and a visiting fellow at the Atlantic Council. Isaac, how dangerous would it be for the average athlete to use a personal cell phone or laptop? Is it such a big deal?
I think some people in the world we live in now are very comfortable being an open book on their private communication. For those, it's not dangerous. For everyone else, say it's a bit of an issue.
So what happens in China? I mean, what is the actual risk when you're on the ground?
The risk is that either through malware or through a Chinese network or through other types of intrusion, that arms of the Chinese government, whether it be the Ministry of State Security or even the Foreign Ministry, will have access to both the communications coming in and out of the phone and also other details, data, photos on the phone or on the laptop. And it's going to be very difficult for a lot of athletes who, you know, want to be posting on social media and want to be talking to friends and loved ones in the States.
So Beijing held the Summer Olympics in 2008. Did we get any kind of hint of this kind of operation then?
Such a different world, both in terms of technological advancements, and also that was the era of Hu Jintao, who was, you know, didn't feel like it at the time, but a much more mild, less authoritarian leader than Chairman Xi Jinping, who rules China today.
So being spied on is more than just a theoretical possibility for you, Isaac. You lived in China for 7 years. You traveled to every Chinese province. How did you deal with worries about data being compromised on your phone and computer?
I think I try to, on the one hand, keep as good types of protection that I can, whether it be via two-factor authentication and VPNs and using Signal or using WhatsApp as opposed to open phone lines, but also, you know, trying to resign myself to the fact that if the Chinese government and, frankly, the U.S. government and a few other, the Russian government too, if they want to get into your device, they will.
Yeah.
You know, if they can hack Microsoft, they can hack us.
Is it just the possibility of being spied on? I mean, are there other risks of taking your dedicated smartphone to China as an Olympian and then bringing it back home?
The risk is less for the individual and more for Chinese people that they could come in contact with. You know, certainly for journalists, but also for some athletes who have activist bents. If they're talking to Chinese citizens and there's a record of those Chinese citizens saying things that Beijing chooses to deem as criminal or critical, it could be putting them in real danger. So they describe this as the idea of a ring of fire. In a lot of cases, people with U.S. passports, especially people without Chinese ethnicity, are a lot more protected than Chinese citizens themselves, whose record of communication with you can bring them trouble, even if their devices are entirely secure.
Olympians from the Netherlands are being told not to take their phones. The Brits are simply advising athletes against it. Do you think most Olympians will play it safe?
No. I unfortunately don't. I think the lure of social media, the lure of posting on your own Instagram account on the phone that you're comfortable with, you winning a medal or you doing something cool in Beijing, will overweigh the security. And I think, frankly, that's a big mistake.
So what is your advice, Isaac, to anyone traveling to the Olympics? Should even spectators take a spare or like a clean or burner device?
Do not bring any phone or computer that you have private information on that you don't want Beijing to access. And it's not saying if you do this, this will certainly happen. The world is far messier than that, but the risks are way too high.
Isaac Stonefish heads Strategy Risks. He also has a new book coming out. It's called America Second, How America's Elites Are Making China Stronger. Isaac, good to speak with you again. Thank you.
Great to chat, Marco. Thank you.
Places with permafrost. These days when it melts, that's bad news for roads and bridges. That's just ahead. You're listening to The World.
The following message is brought to you by Wise, the smart way to move money internationally. An American sends money to a friend in Australia. An Australian buys from an Indian shop online. An Indian freelancer gets paid by a client in Germany. What do all these people have in common? They use Wise, which means they always get the real exchange rate and super low fees when managing their money across borders. And you will too. Wise has a multi-currency debit card, so you can avoid high fees when you shop overseas, online, or in-store. Wise is designed by international people for international people. Try Wyze for free at wyze.com/world.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Our warming climate is melting the world's ice. In the Arctic, that's happening right under people's feet, under bridges and roads, too. Losing frozen ground has become a bigger and bigger problem for residents in the extreme north. New research out this week finds that more than half of the Arctic's infrastructure is now threatened, requiring tens of billions of dollars in maintenance and repairs. Paul Merkison has seen this up close. He directs transportation programs for the government in Yukon, the territory in northwest Canada. My colleague Carol Hills caught up with him.
Paul, the main vulnerability here is permafrost. What is permafrost?
Permafrost is ground that remains continuously frozen. It's frozen in the summer as well as in the winter. And a good portion of our territory is underlain by permafrost.
So the issue now is that you're losing permafrost?
My area is transportation infrastructure, so focused purely on transportation, roads, bridges, airports. A lot of that infrastructure, you know, about 75% of that in Yukon is built on permafrost. And with climate change, what we're seeing is that permafrost underneath starting to thaw and thawing at accelerated rates. And when that ground thaws, there's often cases a lot of ice in that frozen ground. You imagine like you build a road on an ice cube. When that thaws, the road moves and it moves down and it can be very damaging to the infrastructure.
What does it look like when permafrost melts under a road or bridge? Can you paint a picture for us?
You'll see settlements occurring, and that's the road going down, but the road doesn't go down in a uniform way. The road essentially becomes very wavy, but also because the thawing isn't uniform, the roads will also crack. And then we also see sinkholes developing in some areas. And sometimes these sinkholes, I mean, they're large enough to say to engulf a motorcycle.
I mean, is this kind of a big problem for you now as the head of transportation programs for UConn? I mean, UConn's a big territory. Is this just something you're dealing with all the time?
It's becoming a bigger problem. You know, when we go to rehabilitate or reconstruct sections of road, the question will be, how do we make that section of road resilient to the impacts of climate change now and into the future?
One of the main authors of the research in the journal Nature Reviews Earth and Environment said melting permafrost isn't like an earthquake, it's a slow-moving disaster. How does that affect how planners like you respond to the threat?
I think that's correct. Permafrost does not thaw overnight. So the trends and sort of the trends for increasing damage caused by permafrost is, you know, we're looking at decades there. So that becomes a long-term planning exercise, but that long-term planning exercise is difficult because there's variations in projections as to what the future looks like. So, you know, you're going to build a bridge for a 75-year life cycle. How do you, you know, consider what that climate may look like in 75 and 100 years with those projections? There's a much bigger question mark now around what do we build it for the future? We can't rely on past data like we used to be able to rely on past data because that's not nearly as reliable as it used to be anymore. And so we're lacking that reliability. It's a bit of a shift in trying to make that decision about maintaining reliability, maintaining safety, and how much risk do you accept with the unknown of future climate.
You've worked in the far north for more than a decade. Do you feel like you're watching climate change in real time?
I'm not a longtime northerner. You know, a decade and a bit is still a short time northerner. But I can say even in the time that I've been here, we're seeing climate change impacting the roads in a way that they weren't being impacted even a decade ago. It's much more real for us in the north, I think, generally. If you look at trends, especially in the Western Arctic of North America, the rate of climate change here is much more significant than the rest of North America. So we're seeing more significant changes here more quickly than many other areas.
The World's Carol Hill speaking with Paul Merkison, a transportation engineer with the government of Yukon Territory in Canada. He was speaking from the city of Whitehorse. The island of Zanzibar off the coast of East Africa is marking 58 years since a revolution there took place. That's when people in Zanzibar overthrew their Arab rulers. That happened just 1 month after gaining independence from Britain. Now a new film is revisiting that tumultuous time. The World's Africa correspondent Halima Gikandi spoke with the filmmaker.
Vuta Nkavute. In Swahili, that means tug of war. It's the title of the film by Tanzanian filmmaker Amil Shivji and based on a book of the same name. The story is set in Zanzibar in the 1950s. Today, the East African island is part of the United Republic of Tanzania. Shivji's family has roots in Zanzibar.
I wanted to tell the story of the 1950s, which was a time, it was actually called Zama za Siasa, historically, the political awakening, because it was such a vibrant time.
At the center of the film's story is Denge, a rebellious young black communist. We first meet him as he puts up anti-colonial flyers. They read, "Freedom for Africa Today." Denge meets and falls in love with Yasmin, an Indian Zanzibari bride. She's just run away from her arranged marriage with an older man. In this scene, Yasmin asks Denge why he puts up these revolutionary flyers that could get him arrested. He tells her it's to free himself. "Are you free?" Denge asks Yasmin. Their love is heavily burdened by the times. Zanzibar was rife with racial and ethnic tensions between the black, Arab, and Indian communities that still make up the population of the island today. In this scene, a shackled Denge confronts a British inspector about the political situation.
"What would you lose, really, if you just left us alone?"
"It's not a matter of what I would lose. It's a matter of what the Zanzibaris would lose."
"Our chains, for a start."
"Chains? We've built this island. The roads, the railway, global trade."
"So you can suffocate us?"
"I'm not sure most Zanzibaris would agree with you."
Shivji tells me he didn't want this film to just be about the past. He wanted it to resonate with the political issues facing East African countries today.
"Colonial regimes may be over, but I don't think colonialism is over. I don't think state oppression is over. I think a lot of our states, unfortunately, have implemented and maintained colonial laws, especially in East Africa, if I can speak to it. And if we were able to resist it then why aren't we continuing to resist it now?"
He also wanted to showcase a different side of Zanzibar, which has taken on a religiously and culturally conservative Islamic identity. That wasn't always the case, Amil Shivji tells me.
"I mean, in the 50s, you had women landlords smoking and drinking on the streets, you know. It was unbelievable. It was the Paris of East Africa. That's what it was called."
Indeed, in one scene in the film, we see women and men dancing to the sound of tarab music. That's a popular local music with Arab influences. Last month, Tug of War premiered in Zanzibar to a crowded audience. Shivji says he hopes to show the film at festivals around the world, including in the United States. For the World, I'm Halima Gikandi in Nairobi.
You're listening to The World. Tensions are rising in Bosnia. Experts say it's the country's worst crisis in more than 25 years.
"All I see among people is fear on all sides.
Fear that Bosnian Serbs are about to pull out of the government they've shared with Bosnian Croats and Muslims.
It is effectively secession in all but name."
That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. One of the biggest achievements during this pandemic has been the lightning-fast pace of vaccine development. But getting the vaccines delivered and into the arms of people has not been easy. Here at The World, we were wondering which country has the highest COVID vaccination rate. Think you know? It's not in North America or in Europe. Maybe your mind is going to the obscure, like Oceania, perhaps. Here with the answer is The World's Ilana Gordon.
I want to start with who's not number one. Somewhat tied for third are Chile and Cuba. A few steps ahead is Portugal. But in the lead, with at least 92% of its population reported to be fully vaccinated, is a country located right on the eastern coast of the Arabian Peninsula, a place with six ruling families and host of Expo 2020, the World's Fair. It's happening as we speak. Welcome to the United Arab Emirates.
"We would love to get a bit more global recognition, but we know at the end of the day, truth be told, we do this for the citizens of the United Arab Emirates and the residents, expatriates, anyone who's living here.
Emmanuel Azad Munazar is a professor of health policy at the Mohammed bin Rashid School of Government in Dubai. Munazar consulted with the government early in the pandemic. He says trade, business, government leaders all got on the same page and have communicated clearly ever since.
It was important for the country to recognize that we don't create that panic. You know, we create trust, we create transparency.
They also put in place fines for anyone spreading medical misinformation that contradicts the government. For Rihanna Buhaka, a manager with WHO's Eastern Mediterranean Regional Office, another thing gave the UAE an advantage. They acted fast.
Well, first, they started early. They had a commitment with China to test the first vaccine that was out, which was Sinopharm.
By the summer of 2020, some 30,000 people in Abu Dhabi were taking part in a Sinopharm trial. By December, the vaccines went public. They then offered options, Pfizer, Moderna, and Sputnik too. The UAE has a population of about 10 million people. Most are expats or migrants. She says outreach efforts adapted.
In Abu Dhabi, I know people were visiting buildings and were encouraging, especially people who may not understand either Arabic or English, and to put that awareness and messaging in all the languages that were available to convince and to reassure. And that was put in place with the other public health measures.
Leaders also walked the walk. Crown Prince Mohammed bin Zayed publicly took the vaccine. Members of his extended family publicly participated in trials. Religious leaders encouraged vaccinations during gatherings. Andrea Leinberger-Jabari is Assistant Director of the Public Health Research Center at New York University's Abu Dhabi campus.
Seeing the billboards and the posters and things, it really spoke to what would motivate people to be vaccinated. It talked about, you can go see your family, you know, we can gather together, we can, you know, we can take care of each other.
She thinks that collective mentality resonated with people in the UAE. The success of the vaccine campaigns had another big element.
You know, I have an app on my phone that I need to show in order to enter public spaces.
The Al Hosan tracing app. It flashes red if you test positive for COVID. You can make vaccine appointments through it. It shows your testing and vaccine status, and it's key to getting in places. Stephen Cook is a senior fellow with the Council on Foreign Relations.
I think it's subtle, but if you need an app to demonstrate that you've been vaccinated and you have business in Abu Dhabi and you're in Dubai or one of the other Emirates, and that there are checkpoints along the roads, you're going to be sure that you're going to be vaccinated.
Cook says the UAE has shown an amazing capacity to respond. The region has a history of addressing other respiratory disease threats. But the UAE is also not a democracy.
There's ways in which the government can compel people to comply.
Even with its success, the country still faces challenges. The vaccines were more recently authorized for kids. Some families aren't sure about it. But the UAE has one more big advantage: logistics. The country is expanding cold storage facilities to house millions of vaccines for other countries. Again, Professor Emmanuel Azad Munazar.
The UAE is quite strategic with respect to having one of the largest hubs when it comes for export, imports, and so forth.
It's a super wealthy place, and it's becoming more self-sufficient. It's making vaccines, Sinopharms, about 2 million a month. Munazar says this will help them better prepare for whatever's next. But he doesn't think the UAE is winning any kind of vaccine competition.
Many countries haven't even seen one vaccine for their country and so forth.
He says if you can't get the whole world vaccinated right now, then everyone's lost. For The World, I'm Alana Gordon.
A Palestinian man facing eviction from his home threatened to blow up canisters rather than surrender to Israeli police. This happened in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of East Jerusalem, a flashpoint of the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians. For more on what's going on, we're joined by Merav Zonshine. She's a senior analyst on Israel-Palestine with the International Crisis Group and joins us from Tel Aviv. Merav, place us briefly, if you would, in Sheikh Jarrah. Where is it and why is it so controversial?
Sure. Well, Sheikh Jarrah is in East Jerusalem. It's very, very close to the center of West Jerusalem, right in the capital city. And it is a flashpoint because there are several Palestinian families who have been living there since just after the country was established in 1948. They are basically refugees who were expelled or forced to leave and ended up living from the 50s on in this neighborhood. It's important, though, to kind of separate between what happened today with some of the other court cases.
Well, let's start with what exactly happened today. Start there.
Right. So today there's basically been a court decision by the Jerusalem municipality. This is a city decision, a public decision to evict the family from their home and use the space where their home is to build a school for public use, eminent domain. This is different than kind of private battles that usually happen in this neighborhood. And so the police came this morning. They had already told the family for months now that they needed to get out of there. The family refused. So the police showed up today in pretty big numbers and was trying to forcefully get them to leave. And the father of the house, as well as I think about five of his children and several other people who live there, part of the family, all got up on the roof and said that they were refusing to leave. And so there's been like a standoff all day long. And so far, the police have not succeeded in evicting them.
There was this threat to blow up canisters. What were those canisters and did that happen?
It didn't happen. I think he just took the gas tank, you know, that he uses in his home, and he just took it in kind of a plea of desperation and a kind of a way to use whatever weapons he had to try to stave off. And I think he threatened to set fire to the house so that they wouldn't actually be able to take it.
So Israelis and Palestinians, as you said, are both claiming this land in Sheikh Jarrah. Tell us about the claims of both sides.
Well, so in this specific case, as I said, it's different than other cases. The battles that go on in Sheikh Jarrah usually, and some of the ongoing court cases that have led to major tensions in the neighborhood and imminent evictions, are due to private Jewish Israeli citizens who use the help of right-wing groups to try and reclaim properties that they claim Jews owned before the state was established in 1948. Now, Palestinians don't have the same rights. They have also lost many homes. And they don't have the same rights to reclaim those properties. So those are properties in which both lay claim to the land. These are Palestinian families who have been living there since the 1950s. In this specific case, this was a city order in which they wanted to use that space to build a school. Now, some of the left-wing politicians who arrived in support of the family pointed out that there's open plots of land that are just meters away that can be used to build a school. There's no need to evict a family in order to build a school. And in many cases, when Israel has had to use open spaces, it is also, if it has had to evict families, for example, Jewish families, then it would actually compensate them. And in this case, there was no compensation offered.
Generally, have the Palestinian families found legal recourse or any avenues to stay in the neighborhood?
They've managed to kind of get these things caught up in court cases that lag on for years and years, but there hasn't been much success. It's been mostly staving off eviction at this point. And in the case of what happened, for example, in May, which triggered much of the conflict that went across the land, including with Gaza and Hamas, it was a case in which three families were threatened with eviction. And they were offered a compromise by the courts. They refused that compromise because it would have meant that they would be ceding their ownership. And so that is ongoing. And the Supreme Court now has to step in and make a decision. And I think it's kind of delaying that decision because it knows that once it makes it, it will have to evict those families. And that will cause tensions to rise once again.
I mean, the fact, though, that this neighborhood controversy spread across the country, as you said, last May and went into the Gaza Strip and rockets and missiles started flying, it shows just how consequential the whole thing is.
I mean, it really is. And it's also in the last few days in the south of Israel, where there's large Bedouin communities who live in the desert. They have also been resisting certain acts of attempts to kind of claim the land there. And it's another kind of property dispute. And what we're seeing are that Palestinians in various places, whether they're citizens inside Israel or in the case of East Jerusalem, they are residents, they're not even citizens. Or in the West Bank, you basically have Palestinians who are resisting the state's attempts to move them out of their land. There's always different reasons that the state gives, but the overarching theme here is that Israel is trying to replace certain areas from Palestinians and put Jews in their place. And Palestinians are saying, no, we're not willing to move. This is our land.
Merav Zonshein, she's a senior analyst on Israel-Palestine with the International Crisis Group. She joined us from Tel Aviv. Merav, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thanks so much.
You may have heard the story we brought you last week about giant sinkholes in central Turkey. They've been caused by drought, which leads people to dig deeper for groundwater. What you may not realize is how incredibly big these sinkholes can get. Our correspondent, Duri Bhaskaran, took photos while speaking to local farmers. Check out the images on our website, theworld.org. Bosnia and Herzegovina is in the midst of what many experts are calling its worst crisis since the 1990s. That's when ethnic conflict between Serbs, Croats, and Muslims killed more than 100,000 people there. Bosnia is now led by three presidents, each representing one of those three groups. But the Serb president is once again threatening to secede from the country, raising fears that ethnic conflict could break out again. Reporter John Last has more.
All I see among people is fear on all sides.
Aida Cherkez is a Bosnian journalist. In the 1990s, she covered the country's bloody civil war for the Associated Press, witnessing firsthand Europe's only genocide since the Second World War.
I see the same signs and the same positions like in 91 and 92. The nationalist rhetoric, the glorifying of war crimes, the old conflicts are resurfacing again.
The Republika Srpska is Bosnia's Serb ethnic enclave. Last month, their leaders initiated a process that would see them withdraw from the country's multi-ethnic institutions, like the courts, border police, and army. These were established to unify the country in the wake of the last war. The plan would create independent Serb authorities and use force against anyone who would stop them.
It is effectively secession in all but name.
Jasmin Mijenovic is a Bosnian political scientist and author. He says the trigger for this latest plan was a law criminalizing genocide denial imposed by Bosnia's high representative, a kind of internationally appointed governor. In the past decade, leaders like Milorad Dodik, Bosnia's Serb co-president, have routinely minimized the crimes of the past, dishing out military honors to convicted war criminals, even marking the anniversary of the genocide as a national day of celebration. Mujanovic says the High Representative's Law was the excuse Dodik needed, but breaking up Bosnia's fragile union has long been on his agenda. Majda Ruga agrees. She's a senior policy fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations.
This current crisis is actually a continuation of Dodik's, you know, maybe decade-long salami slicing tactics, which consists of really gradually picking the Bosnian central government apart.
The true goal, Ruga says, is less central oversight for Dodik and his allies. She's not sure the Republika Srpska can actually afford to follow through on its threats. But some analysts say this time is different, because this time Dodik has friends in high places. Russia has been supporting Dodik's agenda at the UN Security Council and is threatening to weaken international influence in Bosnia further. Meanwhile, EU member states like Hungary and Croatia are vetoing a European response, with Hungary's right-wing president Viktor Orban openly backing Dodik's brand of ethnic nationalism. Adnan Cheremagic is a senior analyst with the European Stability Institute.
The issue now is that the forces that want to destroy Bosnia and Herzegovina as a state, that want to destroy everything that was achieved since 1996, are receiving support from inside the EU, and they see that their vision actually might be realized.
In recent weeks, there's been some attempt to reassert Western influence. The U.S. imposed sanctions on Dodik and his entourage earlier this month, the first major intervention since the war. Some European countries may also follow suit. But Bosnians know sanctions alone won't fix their country's problems. Gorana Mlinarević is a feminist activist and researcher from Sarajevo.
The peace agreement, as it was actually drafted, was only drafted to appease the warmongering forces in the country. That actually turned out to be easily manipulated.
Mlinarević says the root of today's conflict is the Bosnian constitution itself, an annex in the peace agreement. It was designed, she says, to end a war, which meant dividing power between ethnic leaders from the Serb, Croat, and Bosniak communities. But that leaves no room in politics for more nuanced and mixed identities, driving divisions further.
We have ethnic groups as economically and socially divided more than it was before the war.
Mlinarević says ethno-nationalists like Dodik are the main beneficiaries of the constitution as written, and now they've paralyzed the institutions that could actually reform it for the better. For Yasmin Mijanovic, the political scientist, that means it's time the countries that drafted this agreement get off the sidelines, including the United States.
As long as Bosnia kind of remains on this perennial back burner, we're going to veer from one significant crisis to the next. And sooner or later, and I fear it's very much sooner, the dam will just necessarily break. If Mr. Dodik is not stopped, essentially local actors on the ground, both him and those seeking to stop him, will take matters into their own hands.
Dodik has given his legislators 6 months to withdraw from Bosnia's institutions. If they do, armed conflict may well return to Bosnia once again. For The World, I'm John Last in Padua, Italy.
The FBI is still sorting through what happened in Colleyville, Texas this weekend. That's where a lone gunman held members of a synagogue hostage for 11 hours. One hostage was released, three others escaped. An FBI team killed the gunman, a 44-year-old British national, Malik Faisal Akram. There is still a lot we're learning about the incident. Today, we wanted to discuss the wider security implications for Jewish communities across the globe. For that, we turn to Michael Masters. He's the director and CEO of the Secure Community Network, an organization that helps Jewish communities with security and safety initiatives. So one of the hostages was the rabbi, Michael, Charlie Citron Walker. He credited security courses that were run partially through your organization. He said that that awareness helped them escape. Can you tell us about what you are actually teaching and what the goal is?
Most simply, and thank you for having me on, Marco, it boils down to the simple phrase, commit to action. As the rabbi noted, his priority was to stay alive, and that's exactly what we teach. It's through a combination of recognizing suspicious behavior, knowing what to do when someone presents a threat, how to respond to it, and of course, coordination with law enforcement. And we are beyond gratified that the three hostages, at the end of the day, four hostages total, made it out alive. They're safe and they're at home with their families. And we were honored to be, in some small part, a part of that.
Do most synagogues in the U.S. and around the globe have security in place in case of an attack?
We have seen an increasing emphasis on security, particularly here in the United States, prior to this attack. Certainly post the attack in Pittsburgh on October 27, 2018, 6 months later, the attack in Poway at the Chabad synagogue there. Unfortunately, anti-Semitism, as we know, is well close to 3,000 years old. So the Jewish community has been under attack since that time. But we have seen increasing investments here in the United States to address that very significantly and collaboratively with law enforcement. We face in this country, prior to the pandemic, one active threat situation every 2 weeks on average. A significant portion of those offenders are motivated in some part by anti-Semitism or other grievances. So it's imperative as a community that we work to protect ourselves.
My thoughts turn to France, a country that has seen numerous attacks on synagogues over the years. How does the approach to security in synagogues in the U.S. compare with other countries, like in France and other parts of Europe?
Well, I think one distinguishing factor, if we look back before the pandemic, you know, in all of Europe in 2017 and 2018, there were roughly 75 people killed in terrorist attacks. For the same years in the U.S., 238 people were killed and 807 injured. So the magnitude of issues that we face in this country is just very different than other places. And firearms were used in over 82% of all mass attacks each year in this country. And that's a distinguishing factor. Law enforcement trains regularly for what we call soft targets, but they're not soft targets. These are civil institutions in our country. They're synagogues, they're churches, they're schools. That reality is much different than most places around the world. A distinguishing factor is that the apparatus that's in place here in the United States, largely done through federations, is comprised of professionals. We have former law enforcement, military, national security experts who are working every day to train facilities. And it's exactly one of those professionals with a background in the military and law enforcement that trained the congregants at Congregation Beth Israel.
So we only have about less than a minute, but it's notable that Rabbi Citron Walker took the lessons to heart. He threw a chair at the gunman, we've learned, distraction enough for him and the other hostages to escape. It is really brave, but what does it tell you that such security lessons are necessary in 2022?
Well, unfortunately, as the rabbi said, and we often note, this isn't the world that we would choose to live in, but it is the world that we have. And that means that we need to be prepared. The threat is not going away. The Jewish community is under threat, and we have to be ready, vigilant, and strong. The rabbi and the three other individuals demonstrated that with a level of calm and courageousness, and thankfully supported by law enforcement. We're glad they're home safely with their families today.
Michael Masters, the director and CEO of the Secure Community Network. He's also the president of the Sufan Center. Michael, thank you very much.
Thank you.
When you go to a restaurant, remember that, going out to eat, it is the question that invariably stalls the order. Your choice of salad dressing. Well, for years, there wasn't much choice. Blue cheese, ranch, Thousand Island, and...
Hangy Catalina French, and the head of the French family, Creamy Kraft French.
French dressing, a reddish, orangish concoction with a sweetness bordering on ketchup. Since 1950, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration has had rules that essentially established a recipe for French dressing, at least 35% vegetable oil, along with certain acidifying ingredients like salt, sugar, and tomato paste.
Now, ladies, which will it be?
French!
French!
After 7 decades of that formula, last week the Association for Dressings and Sauces, yeah, that's a real thing, they pressured the FDA to free French dressing. Here's the thing, though. Liberating French dressing from its recipe should not be licensed to improvise. Real French dressing is about minimalism, as chef Jacques Pépin explained in a lesson on making a basic green salad on his KQED cooking show, Techniques.
I never understand people buying dressing for salad. If you look at it, most dressing have at least 25% sugar. If you have more than 20-25% sugar, it is a dessert.
Who wants a sweet sauce on your greens like caramel on an ice cream sundae? Let me summarize Monsieur Pépin's dressing lesson. A real French vinaigrette is also a misnomer because vinegar actually plays a small part. You do need it, but for a salad for one person, a tablespoon of extra virgin olive oil, a quarter teaspoon of red wine vinegar, salt, black pepper, and the key component...
Pardon me, would you have any Grey Poupon?
A solid teaspoon of Dijon mustard. Mix well, and regardless of how the FDA sees it, that's French salad dressing. It is good, but as Jacques Pépin says, it should barely be seen on the green leaves of lettuce.
You want the whole thing to be glossy.
Glossy is the word, not gloppy. Maybe this marks the end of the FDA's salad days. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.